Okay. I've learned to worry more about my easy, good, quiet kids. There's a very fine line between a tzedakis, a superwoman, and a doormat, right? And sometimes the truth is a lie. And I'll give you an example.
Hi, I'm Rivka.
And I'm Ida. Welcome to From the Inside Out, now a global community that keeps growing every day, thanks to each and every one of you.
Right here is where you'll discover life-changing insights from some of the world's greatest thinkers, leaders, and our everyday heroes.
We believe that meaningful change comes from taking inspiration and turning it into action.
In fact, that's how this podcast was created, in an Uber, where we were both inspired by each other's life experiences and how much we could learn from each other.
We're so glad you've joined our conversation today. The path to meaningful change starts right here, right now.
From the Inside Out, this episode is dedicated by Toby Adler. She is an independent business owner, and she's had a photography business for 15 years now. Check out her beautiful page on Instagram at Toby Adler Photography, T-O-B-Y-A-D-L-E-R, Photography. We're going to put the link in our podcast notes. And the reason she is dedicating this episode is because she said she loves our podcast, and so she listens to it when she edits her pictures, and we're very grateful, Toby, that you're one of our listeners, and thank you so much. It's so meaningful that you've decided to dedicate an episode to us.
Thank you, Toby, and we love that we're part of your creative process too. Today's guest, Asari Chair, you might have heard of her. She is a healer, a coach, human behavioral specialist, teacher, and student of crystals and stones, and very intriguing and fascinating individual who definitely gave us a lot to think about.
I appreciated hearing from her because she has spent so much time with people in pain and watched their journey of healing, and to be able to learn from her in her life, in her healing journey, and hear from her about how others can heal. It's very insightful for our healing journeys.
There's so many different forms of healing, but here's one that I hope you can benefit from.
And like you'll hear within the episode, Sarit was sharing that healing is something that takes place for a lifetime. We never completely heal. We heal in one way, and then we realize we need to heal in another way. So it's a freeing feeling to know, okay, I'm never going to fully heal, but I can always learn and grow and find ways to find fulfillment and happiness and better my relationships and better myself.
And was that thing you shared, Rivka, striving and arriving?
I'm trying to remember.
It was in a bunch of episodes ago. You were saying that we should have this feeling as if we've arrived, but always be striving, something like that.
Don't find yourself in a perpetual state of striving without ever experiencing the taste of arriving.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess we're throwing in a quote in the introduction here.
Yeah.
Usually we wait till the end, but I think it's a worthy one. Striving and arriving. We should have both. I mean, there should be this consistent feeling that we're growing and we're progressing, but at the same time, always a feeling that we're exactly where we're meant to be. And having those two parts, I think, can enable us to feel a certain sense of contentment and joy. At the same time, you can always want more and want to be more and want to do more. That's why we're here. We also hope you're enjoying our new social media channels that are growing really nicely. It's pretty cool to watch.
Yeah, this episode as well. Yes, it's pretty cool to watch the growth. We realize we have to get with the times and start videoing our episodes so that they're not only audio, but that you get to see us in person. And so
we're striving and arriving.
Yeah, exactly. Check out our social media page if you haven't yet.
From the Inside Out podcast.
And now we have a YouTube channel.
Yeah.
And you'll see when you're on the Instagram page, you'll see links to our YouTube channel as well.
If you'd like to sponsor an episode, you can email rivkaandida@gmail.com. We'd love to partner with you in a future upcoming episode.
Ida and I feel very blessed to have met you. We both experienced healing with you, and we both felt that you have a sixth sense. We're wondering
Did you always feel like you had the sixth sense? Is it something you developed?
So, you know what? As a child, I felt very intuitive, even though I don't think I knew what intuitive meant. I would pick up on people's emotions. If someone was sad, I would be the first one to come in and cheer them up, whereas other people might not have noticed. I definitely would pick up on people's energies and people's personalities, I would say, and I would get a sense for things that were developing in a person. Like I would ask people if they weren't feeling well when they were fine, and then the next day they weren't feeling well. Things like that, you know, but I feel like when you're born into a Sephardi family and you have this sort of sixth sense, like it's a natural thing. It's something that nobody thinks is a big deal. You know, like if you say, oh, I knew she was going to have a boy, then like, oh, I also knew, you know, like it's a kind of culturally more expressed thing, intuition in the Sephardi community. Whereas in the Ashkenazic world, it sounds a little crazy, you know, but I grew up knowing that I was more intuitive than the average person. And it was only till later, actually, once I had my daughter, that I went to a very big Hasidic Rebbe, and he told me, he said, you know, Sari, you're very gifted intuitively, and I think that you should go into the healing. And I thought it was insane. I thought that, what kind of a thing is that? Like healing, I knew from movies of like these crazy people that put their hand, closed their eyes, and made noises, and it seemed almost unnatural and strange. At the time, I was working as a lease abstractor for a company in Israel, an all-women's company, and it was too strange. I'm very much a square person who I do things by the book, and I like everything to look normal, and I'm very balanced. And so had the Rebbe not pushed me in that direction, I don't think that I would have ever had the courage to ever go into such a field, because it just seems so out of the box for me.
Wow.
But yeah, he was definitely the catalyst for me becoming a healer, and he pushed me very hard to do it. He told me what classes to take, what courses, what not to do, what yes to do. He always also told me, like, don't get too medical, because I want you to keep your intuition. Don't use your chachma, as they say. Don't use your intellect. He's like, just keep your intuition clean. Don't get too much information. And so he guided me along the entire path until I was able to leave my job, and I studied for a few years analytical reflexology. I studied analytical crystal healing. I studied healing itself. And over the years, I've studied many other healing modalities like 3D healing, Dr. Sarno's method. And I kind of took from every kind of healing and emotion codes, and I kind of made it my own. And basically the premise of the whole thing is that a lot of times people look as illness, or as, you know, blockages in their life, as this thing that God put upon me, and now I have to kind of deal with it. Maybe it's a punishment, maybe it's something bad that's happening to me, and I look at it completely differently. I obviously believe that everything comes from God, and that God does create that. But I look at the universe in a different light, in the sense where God puts sort of a setup and a frequency system, where if you're in balance, then the universe will send you back balance. And if you're out of balance, then your body will send you signals. Your life will send you signals. You're going to start to get blocked. It could be romantically, it could be physically. And what I look to see is, why is your body creating these blockages? What is it looking for? And then I try to uncover what it is and help you release it. That's basically how I work.
So would you say you essentially try to help people find their clarity? And I guess the question more is, how do you help people find clarity? In what way? Can you share some examples?
So people come in basically not telling me anything. And I mean, you guys have experienced this yourself. You come in, I have like 200 mineral stones, you choose the stones, and according to what you chose, the amount you chose, and the order you put it in, it basically gives me a mapping reading of what you're going through. And I'll tell you, I see this and this and this and this. I'll look at the bottom of the feet to check for illnesses and markers on your foot. And then basically, after I've done those two things, I'll close my eyes, I'll take your hand, and I'll tap into your subconscious. And this is the intuitive part, where I'll pick up on messages that your body is telling me in terms of what I saw on the stones and what I saw on the foot. And so sometimes I'll see something inside of you, but if I don't see it in the stones, I won't bring it up, because there are certain things that I might see, but you might not be ready to hear. So for example, if I have a woman who's having heavy marital issues, if I didn't see it in the stones, which there are stones for that, I might pick up on it because that's what she's expressing. But I know the stones kind of give me the limitations and the boundaries to know what to touch and what not to touch. Because just because you know something about someone doesn't mean you should bring it up. Because sometimes they're not ready to go there. Sometimes it's too much of a hot topic. Maybe they're not emotionally prepared for it. And so I'll just bring up what the stones show. And sometimes people will be like, I came in for a toothache and you're telling me something else. I go according to what I feel is the most important thing. The person could be coming in for something else. They could be coming in for infertility, and I'll talk about their financial fears, right? And people sometimes find it confusing. And I'll say, look, you have infertility, really, because it's a symptom of this fear of how can I support my family? And most of your issues in life are coming from this financial fear. And so I basically, when someone comes to me, I look to see what is this person manifesting in their life that's actually not allowing them to be balanced, not allowing them to live their best life. And so I kind of look into the subconscious, into their childhood traumas, at the map of their foot, at the stones that they choose. And I kind of make an assessment of how we can help this person shift frequencies, change gears, and go into a new path of healing.
Wow. So a person might not even know themselves what they need. Yeah. And then the healer will bring out the part of them that needs healing.
Yes. And sometimes I'll argue with a client and they'll say, I had a client, actually a very famous client, that she came in for infertility and I would not work on infertility for a year because she had so many other issues that I felt were leading to the infertility, that there was no energetic space for a child to come into that home. There was too much chaos.
But you were, in essence, working on infertility because you were working on her issues.
Right. And I knew that the child could come when it felt that there was a safe space for the child. And because of certain bad habits that she had, it wasn't possible. And so as much as she wanted to just work on that specific issue, I knew that we first had to create a solid grounding for her in order to bring a life into the house.
Wow. So energy healing, it sounds like something that we all can benefit from, because maybe some of us don't know what problem we need to solve. And so many people might be solving the wrong problem.
Right. Listen, people say energy healing. I don't even know why it got that word, that name.
And is that your word?
People put that on me because I think out of lack
even,
of...
You said, it sounds like even you were like, well...
Yeah, I was like, you know, people call me even healer. I never really gave myself that name.
Oh, so what name do you like?
I don't know. I just stuck. I feel like God is the only healer. So it feels almost pompous to call yourself a healer. I'm very uncomfortable with it, but it sticks to me no matter what.
Right.
Because people just technically need to give it a name.
Right.
I wish there was like a long sentence you can say, like facilitator for people's own personal development and healing. But that doesn't fly as healer. It's just faster.
Right.
But I definitely think that a person heals themselves. I'm happy to be a facilitator for that healing. I'm not sure about this whole energy thing, but I think that
people... Aren't you picking up on people's energy?
Obviously, that's a part of it. Mm-hmm. But I think that I'm more picking up on people's bad habits and bad behavior patterns. Mm. But sometimes, for example, with like when I work on small children or babies, so it never really has anything to do with the small child or the baby. It has to do with the parent. And so, yes, when I'm working on with their energies, I'm seeing what's affecting that child. Mm-hmm. When I work with adults, I'm working with them because that's really who they are. But when it comes to small children, I would say mostly under the age of 6, it has nothing to do with the child itself.
Yeah.
Has to do with the parent.
That makes sense.
I had a story with a client who came in. She didn't even come in with her daughter because she didn't want to bring it up in front of her daughter. And she just brought a picture. And basically, she told me that her 9-year-old daughter had an eating disorder. She just decided that she was fat and she wouldn't eat. And she looked into it and she said it wasn't coming from her friends. She never discussed food at home. Her child was thin. She herself was thin. And one day her daughter decided that she's fat and she can't eat. And no matter what her mother tried to do, she couldn't convince her. So her mother came to see what was going on here. What happened to my daughter? And I was able to surmise that actually this inner voice, this dialogue that this child was having had nothing to do with the child. It had to do with the mother. And her inner voice and her inner dialogue was, I'm fat, I hate my body, I don't love myself. I saw it from the stones that she took. And it was true. The mother started crying and she told me that she really hated her body and she hated it. And she was beautiful and thin. But she was overweight as a child. And basically there's something called inherited trauma. And that the age that she started to gain weight was the same exact age that her daughter turned when she turned 9. And automatically this sort of fell on her like an inheritance. And it triggered her. And basically she stopped eating. And so I never actually worked on the child. I only worked on the mother. And as soon as we released the mother from her traumas of her emotional eating as a child and her self-loathing, her daughter just started eating one day. It took about 2 sessions and it had nothing to do with the child. And so often,
wow,
you know, we inherit.
So this could be in many different scenarios.
Yes.
If our children are in
yes.
pain.
Yes.
It could be you need to release something from the parent.
Don't you
Absolutely.
Feel like that's such a, you know, as a mom, I feel responsible for my children's well-being. How does a mother take
Not
that responsibility without the guilt? No, without feeling this pressure of like, if something's going wrong with my child, then
it's my fault.
It's my fault. Or I have to do, what do I have to do? Or what
well,
did I
I'll
do?
Well, I'll tell you first offhand, no matter what I tell you, you're going to feel that way.
Okay.
Because mothers are empathic and we're givers. And the thing we give our kids the most is guilt and inherited guilt.
Right.
And it's human nature to feel like everything is my fault. I always look at it as like, not that everything is my fault, but that a mother has a lot of power. And so there are things that I will inherit my kids that are amazing. There are things that I'll inherit my kids that are hard. I often see that children are a reflection of everything that we need to work on in almost an ironic way, right? Every child shows me a different facet of myself. It actually, I use it to motivate myself to fix certain things about myself because I don't want to see it in my kids. And sometimes it's just out of my control. We're exhausted. And so basically when we see certain things in ourselves and our kids, it's A, supposed to motivate us to stop and to fix ourselves. And B, it also sometimes because we experienced it, we can give them the right guidance to pass it or to overcome it. And I don't like to look at it as like everything is my fault because at the end of the day, God puts us through certain experiences and he gave me this child. And even if I inherited him all this awful stuff, he wanted that to happen.
Right.
And he chose me with all of my baggage to have this child. And I was maybe supposed to clean up 30% of the baggage. And now she has to clean up 50% of the baggage. And maybe her daughter will clean up the rest of the baggage. And we're not perfect beings. And it always reminds me of this Calvin and Hobbes, you know, the cartoon
yeah.
where, you know, I think Calvin says to Hobbes, I think I'm going to live forever. And he goes, really? Why? He goes, because my mom says that we live as long as we can until we fix ourselves. And so we all have a pretty long life to live since we're basically here on a journey of fixing and healing. And it doesn't really help to sit there and sort of like, you know, agonize over everything you've done wrong and how we're not the perfect mothers. I think it's women do that more naturally because it's part of our essence. It's part of our personality to fix.
Right.
So we're constantly fixing ourselves, fixing our kids, fixing the house, fixing the way we dress, fixing our body. Women work more as fixers in general. So we have that tendency. And a lot of the times when women come to me, the first thing I need to do is get them to stop that self-loathing, to stop the self-criticism and say, yes, I might have inherited my child this emotional eating issue, but this soul is destined to inherit this. And so right. it was destined to be my child and I can help that child.
And I think you answered the question with your example because the mother brought her daughter in for the eating disorder. So I think maybe as a parent,
that was her job.
The way to differentiate is, well, if this triggers me, this thing about my child triggers me and I'm getting help for it, then there's something within me that's making myself feel triggered. So let's say this mother might not be triggered by her daughter messing up her room, right? Which is also could be a trigger for another mom. And so I guess the question would be, how much is this affecting me emotionally, me? And maybe that's when we can start addressing that.
Exactly.
That's where I can separate the guilt. I'm
not saying if it's affecting you emotionally, it could possibly be that it's because it's something that you have that you're seeing.
Right, exactly.
Daughter.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. Right.
Yes.
I think that's a very wise and healthy approach because that will prevent criticism. And, you know, it holds us back from criticizing our children because, hey, this could be something, this is probably something I need to work on.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know what I always say? You know, moms come to me all the time. Recently, one of my good friends was crying to me that her son is a teenager and he's going off the path and he's not going to school and he's rebelling. And I happen to have gone to high school with her. And I was like, babe, so you remember us in high school? what were we doing in high school? She's like, yeah, it's different, but we didn't grow up like that. And I gave them this kind of childhood and that. And I was just like, just look at your kid like it's you. You know, when we were teenagers, we were nuts. We did crazy things. We wanted freedom. We wanted to just watch TV. We wanted to have fun. Our kids aren't different than us, but we kind of put all of our expectations of all of our failed sense of identity on our kids when we have them. They're going to be different than me. I'm not going to make the same mistake my parents did. I'm going to be the perfect mom. And my child is the proof of that. And it's so off because everybody thinks that. Our moms thought that, their moms thought that. And the truth is that we're basically setting ourselves up for failure. And actually, I always ask this question to people and nobody has an answer. I wonder if you two will. It says that God made Adam and Eve. It says that he made Adam from the ground, from the earth, and he made Eve from Adam. Now, the first thing he says to them is, "Vayazov ish et aviv ve'etimo vayidbek l'ishto," and you shall now leave your father and your mother and cling to your wife. What father and mother? He just made him from the ground, and he made her from him. You could just imagine Adam and Eve looking at each other and being like, what's he talking about? What's that, right? What is this? What is this conversation? The first thing God says Adam and Eve when he makes them, there is no parents. They don't have parents. So what is he talking about? Why is it the first message that mankind gets for all time that's embedded in the Bible? Why is the first thing leave your parents?
Leave any preconceived notions.
Because we need to be independent and grow and learn how to thrive on our own.
Exactly. And you should know that when he was talking about parents, it obviously wasn't an actual physical parents because they didn't have any. It was a concept. And so when we look at ourselves, instead of like the responsible ones for everything that happens to my child, instead, and we look at ourselves as an idea, as a concept, we can take a step back and we can say, God wants each child to know that even though they came from this place, they have their own complete identity. And if Adam had, and if Abraham had followed his father's path, there never would have been the Jewish people. And so he had to sort of go against the grain. And God is teaching us that growth comes from going against the grain, even if we're the grain. And so when we see our kids starting to rebel, it's healthy. It means that they have their own mind. It means that they're not, you're not feeding them inherited information. They're trying to create something new for themselves. And sometimes you have to really push hard up against the grain in order to discover who you really are. God's greatest nightmare is that our children should be the junior. He wants individuals. And actually, in all of Judaism, we don't see a very healthy father-son relationship. Okay? Abraham didn't see that his son Ishmael was bothering Yitzhak. And Sarah had to come and say, what's going on here? Yitzhak chose the wrong child. Yaakov favored one child against the rest of the tribes. Moshe wasn't raised by his own father. He was raised by Paro. We don't see David, his father thought he was a bastard and he sent him off. We don't really see a very strong father-son bond in Judaism. And nor do we see anywhere where the mothers are chiming in. Right?
Well, Rivka chimed in. Sarah chimed in.
It's true.
Yeah.
It's true. And they probably saved their kids.
Yeah. mother's intuition.
It's true.
Yeah, but think
it's
of
true.
When they chimed in. They chimed in moments of like extreme.
It was do or die.
Yeah.
Yosef and Yaakov had a special bond. Like Yaakov longed for Yosef.
Right, but like that's kind of problematic when you have 12 kids in your favorite. Okay. Yeah.
Well, it caused a lot of drama.
Yeah, it caused a lot of drama. But you're right. The moms chimed in, but like at the end when it was like already like do or die.
Right.
But throughout the process, it was hard. You know, they had to kind of keep quiet.
So you're saying the leaders that shined, they didn't necessarily have these attachments or like to their
God
to
made
parents.
It very, very hard for the children to follow their parents' path.
Right. They
by creating a lot of dissonance.
Right.
Because those leaders come from dissonance. And so I always tell moms, don't be so upset about the rebellious kids. They're probably going to be overachievers. Okay. I've learned to worry more about my easy, good, quiet kids. Because why aren't they asking questions? Why aren't they going up against the grain? Why aren't they trying to discover themselves? It's harder. But at the end of the day, we want our kids to be their own beings. You know, we want them to be the best versions of themselves. And we don't really know what that is. And so I always say the best kind of parenting is to stay back a little. the best kind of parenting is to be a role model and an example for healthy living and balanced living. It's not what you say to your kids. They're never listening to us. It's not what you make them do. You know, if you want your kids to be a certain thing, if you're not that thing, they'll never be that thing. We know that. And so I always think to myself,
unless they rebel and do the wrong thing.
Right. But I always think, like, whatever attribute I want my kids to do, let me try to work on that for myself. Right. Like, if I want my kids to, let's say, organize their closet, I start organizing mine. It creates a kind of an energy in the space of fixing, and then kind of the house starts to shift into that space.
Yeah, be the change you want to see.
It's exactly. Kind of like be the change you want to see. I would say that. Definitely.
Okay, yeah, that's
for us.
Sorry, we've got our work cut out for us.
Yeah,
sure. But it's also, yeah, it's somehow comforting to hear that, you know, to hear that it's a good thing for children to go off on their own and be independent. And
yeah.
Yeah, I think an intuitive parent would know, like, at what point to step in.
Yeah.
Where there's not codependence there. I think codependency could, like, prevent a parent from stepping in the right circumstances and solving the right problems.
I'm going to tell you guys something crazy, and you're probably not going to want to hear this. But throughout the years of working with people, so I've seen kids who are very badly abused, horribly. I've seen kids that are, like, kind of like good childhood with mixed in with a lot of bad, you know, the average. And then I've seen kids that are, like, amazing parents and super coddled. And the ones that grow up to be the most corrupted and the most damaged are the coddled ones. The greatest achievers are the ones that had really horrible childhoods, if they're able to overcome it. And the ones that kind of had that mixed bag. I would say they're the best. But the coddled ones that had the perfect parents that protected them, that never let them go up against the grain, they're the ones in the most anti-anxiety medication. They're the ones that can't handle life. They're the ones that go into the universe expecting them to continue like their childhood, and it doesn't. And so don't be so upset when your kids are bullied, when they have challenges, when they have ailments, when they go through struggles. It's basically a muscle that's preparing them for the real world. And the real world is a dog-eat-dog place. And they're going to have to pick up skills as a child.
How do you balance that with giving them the tools that they need to succeed? Kind of like, let's say, a parent, you know, doesn't want to intervene in their kid's development, right? But they see their kid struggling. Let's say the kid is being bullied. Let's use that as an example. Like, how would they approach that?
Well, you always want to intervene when a child is being abused, and you want to speak to the right authorities, like the school and the teacher. But sometimes there are scenarios where technically you can't affect change. And you're not going to keep switching them class to class to class to class, because basically you're telling them, when you have a struggle, leave the struggle.
Right.
And what if you're married and you can't leave the marriage?
Right.
What if you have a certain parent, you can't leave the parent? What if your job, you quit and you don't have any way to live? So it has to be a balance. Like I always say this, like, you don't go to the hard right, you don't go to the hard left. You basically speak up, you take care of it with the proper authorities. But most often, as we all know, when you put your kid in school, there's only a limitation of what the school can do.
Right.
And at the end of the day, what you can do that's the best tool for the kid is give them personal life experiences from things that you've experienced in the past, where everybody goes to a stage where they're being bullied. And you help your kid by saying, well, this is how I went through it. I had this challenge when I worked at this job, and this is how I dealt with it. What could we do? And you work with the kid to figure out coping mechanisms. Obviously, as long as they're not at risk. But there are certain scenarios where the kid is still in the class with that kid and the bullying becomes suppressed, where, like, he's not outwardly bullying the kid anymore because he doesn't want to get in trouble, but he's doing it under the radar,
right,
which sometimes is even more painful for the child. And basically what you have to do is gird your child to learn to deal with adversaries, because they're always going to be there. It could be his father-in-law one day. It could be his boss. It could be in the army when he goes and his, you know, mefaked is up against him. There's, you really want to give your kids tools for life. And a lot of it has to come with how you communicate to your kids. And I would say the biggest misconception that parents have with their children is in communication, because what happens is kids come home and then we start to interrogate them. What'd you do? What happened today? Where'd you go? And right away you could see your kid retreat, right? Because they feel like they're being interrogated. Like, why are they asking? What do they want to know? My mom's always trying to fix me. Where is this leading to? And what do kids mostly say? Nothing. Fine. It was good, right? One word answers, like, bug off. But really, true communication isn't interrogating a child, isn't trying to find out information about what happened during the day. It's about teaching them how to share. So I really make an effort to share my day with my kids, to tell them about the hard things and the lows, not too much where it's overwhelming, and not to sound like I'm complaining, and to tell them about funny things that happened in my childhood, to kind of create an open atmosphere in the house of sharing. And my mistakes, my failures. You know, one of the stories I used to tell my kids was my bullying experience as a kid. And I remember when I was telling my kids the story, they were like, "Why didn't you tell Safta?" You know, and they're like, "We would have told you if this happened." And it's not true. And I told my kids, there was times you didn't tell me that you were being bullied, right? And they're like, "Yeah." And I was like, "You know why?" And they're like, "Why?" I'm like, "Because we want to protect our parents, because sometimes we feel like they can't help me anyway. Sometimes we're afraid of our parents intervening and embarrassing me." But kids really thrive when they know that their parents have failures, when their parents made mistakes, when their parents went through hard things, and
so
they're able to share.
Like, if let's say you were going through something hard now, you don't want to put your burden on your child.
Listen, even as parents, sometimes we do that without noticing.
Yes, I'm saying, but
what do you
to
mean
intentionally,
put your burden on your
I'm saying, let's say you're going through a hard time and with something. Would you want to share that with your child, and then they have to listen? Like, they may feel burdened by what you're going through.
Well, you have to really be careful. You have to read the room.
Yeah.
And you have to know that you have to do it in small doses. Your children are not your therapist, and they're not your dumping ground for emotional issues. I usually will share purposeful things that are, I thought about it a lot before I share it, just to make sure that it's, the child can handle it and that it's good. But will I tell you that I'm not perfect all the time? And sometimes I'll have a very hard day and I'll spill something out that I shouldn't, and my kids will be like, TMI, mom. You know, like, we don't want to hear that.
Right.
You want it's good that they say that to you.
Meaning she's not just having her kids become her therapist. She's sharing the problem and the solution.
Yeah. No, I think it's nice
and
to share.
I remember
I exaggerate, and sometimes my kids will call me out on it.
Right.
And kids are intuitive. They pick up on these things whether or not you're sharing them.
Look, we're never perfect, but you want to have kids that will call you out on it. That's really where your parenting is good. Not that I never make mistakes. I make a million mistakes with my kids, but my kids will call me out on it. And I'm happy that I raised kids
that feel comfortable
comfortable to be like, mom, TMI. Okay.
That's who really else is going to tell us?
Exactly. No, our kids love fixing us and telling us everything that's wrong with us, but that it's good. That's a good sign. That means that they feel comfortable with us. That means that they've seen our failures. That means that they think that we're normal, that they can do that, you know?
So you're saying instead of asking questions,
share
and
obviously
and ask.
In a normal way, but yes.
Share and ask. Well, that kind of leads me to ask you just about emotions in general. I mean, we love this quote, where focus goes, energy flows. So if you're sharing a negative emotion, that's going to bring up negative energy. If you're sharing a positive emotion, that's going to bring up positive energy. Well, it actually talks about that in Tanya a lot. In order to tap into the love of Hashem, to talk about that love, and then you start to feel the love. And also, even let's say when you're learning Torah, if you're just learning, it's not going to be the same as when you actually put it into words and then you actually process it. And the same with feelings. When you share, so when we're sharing negativity, or something hard that we're going through, what would you say about that? That you're picking up on, like, the negative thing is actually the thing that's being brought to light.
I mean, let's look at the Torah. The Torah only talks about all the horrible things our forefathers did. And I think that there's a tendency in this generation to kind of be happy, positive thinking. In my healing business, I could tell you that positive thinking is maybe like, I would give it like 20% power over the general overall healing. And if we had to remove it, I could.
Well, I guess when you're healing, you need to talk about the hard things you're going through. You're not coming to talk about the
positivity. It's not just about, I think that this people have to be very wary of this whole positive, 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 positive. Yes, we have to be positive, and we have to be careful of negative energy, but we also have to be real, and we also have to be honest with what's happening. And I think that the Torah advocates authenticity. And I think that if we advocated authenticity over positivity, we would have a completely different generation. And so positivity unbridled is dangerous. It kind of becomes a generation where everything is about making sure the other person feels good to the detriment of the greater good of mankind. So if a child feels that she's a boy, even though she's 3 years old, let's feed in on that. And it might lead to, God forbid, her removing part of her genitalia because she feels a certain way. And we always have to try to feel good. It's a dangerous thing. What I advocate is honesty, authenticity, the ability to see the truth through different challenges in our life. And we see that in the Torah. We see that God always told the truth. But at the same time, why is it that in this generation, this sort of rising of positive thinking is coming up? Because there is a very heavy truth to, if you keep focusing on what's wrong, it's very hard to get to what's right. So you are correct in the sense that we do need to focus on what's right and build on that. But we also don't want to lose our objective, which is what's the truth, right? And sometimes the truth is a lie. And I'll give you an example. It says that when God came with the angels and he said to Abraham, we're going to give you a son. So Sarah was listening in. And she started laughing. And then God came to her and said, why did you laugh? Now, she didn't laugh out loud. She laughed in her heart. And so what did she say to him? She said, well, my husband is old and he kind of gave up on me. And so I laughed. I just couldn't believe it. When God came back to Abraham, what did he say? He said, I asked your wife why she laughed and she said she's old. She never said that. God actually lies. He lies to Abraham because he wanted to make peace. He didn't want to say that she said something bad about him, right? So sometimes for peace, we have to also be inauthentic. And so everything in life is really about balance. It's about looking at every situation for what that specific situation is. And we have to constantly check for authenticity. Because the truth of the whole story with Abraham and Sarah was, and the authenticity of that story was, that she was hurt, that she felt rejected by her husband. So there was no point in telling him something bad that she said about him. Because that's not the truth. That's not authentic. The authenticity is, was that she was felt forgotten. And that's what he gave over to him. And so even though he had to switch the story a little bit, he was trying to get to the bottom, to the point of the truth. And so, yes, we have to use positive thinking and positivity, but not to the detriment of reality. And so oftentimes we don't want to run with a concept like today's generation is running with it, where it's almost like there's no more truth, there's no more authenticity. It's just about making everything feel good, right? What if it feels good to cheat on my husband, God forbid? What if it feels good to a man to go with his secretary instead of his wife? Because it feels good. Because it's positive for me. She makes me feel good. She makes me happy. She puts me in a good mood. My wife is always complaining. Is that what we're going after? What feels good? What feels positive? No, we want to go for authenticity and we want to go for the truth. And sometimes the truth hurts. And so I only use positive thinking when I want to get somebody on a track of helping themselves. It's hard to help yourself when you're negative.
Right. Well, that's what I was talking about more, like when you're trying to heal yourself, mm-hmm. and if let's say you're hurt and you're talking about your negative emotions, sometimes you will find that it feeds your negative emotions by talking about it. It brings it to light. Do you know what I'm saying?
I think in this generation, sometimes therapy gets a bad rap.
Yeah.
And people don't come out of it. Yes. Like they're working on the same issue for 10 years.
Because they're talking about the negative emotions.
Because they keep talking about it and talking about it. I think that it has a place where you bring it up. You have to look at it. But you don't want to stay there.
Right.
Right? But we definitely have to look at it.
So you need to talk to the right person who's going to help you heal.
Right. And we only stay in a negative space for the amount of time we need to deal with it. But then once we know the reality and we looked at the negative thing, we have to build upon and move forward from it. But it's definitely has a place, negativity, but it doesn't have, it's not sustainable negativity, right? There's a reality to it. It's just not sustainable.
It's not sustainable because it's just going to get you into a rut.
It's just you're not going to be able to leave it.
Right.
It's very, very attractive.
Right. Like, is it helping you or is it?
But if you talk about your positive emotions, that's going to lead you to a good place.
Yes. But you know what? Then that leads us a little bit sometimes to narcissism. Right? Everything in the universe has to have balance. Yeah. We have to have positive thinking. We have to sometimes have more constructive thinking. Sometimes we even have to be negative, right?
How would just positive thinking lead to narcissism?
It's not a direct lead, but to only positive thinking can lead to denial, which can then lead to narcissism.
It's like a delusional type
right,
of thinking.
Right. You want to think positive. We also want to be a realist. You know what I'm saying? You have to be critical thinking.
There's this huge self-help movement now where people are becoming so obsessed with healing and with self-help and all of these different methods, which can be beneficial. But in many cases, it's come to the point where some people take it to extremes where it can do more harm than good. And I feel like when it comes to truth, let's say someone's on this journey, right? This healing journey. I feel like all of us are on some healing journey at some point in our lives. Is there a way of knowing if we're moving toward more of, let's say, a narcissistic place in this whole self-healing, which I see some people do, as opposed to, no, this is my self-healing, but I'm working towards like the truth. How does someone know if this is truth? Because it sounds like truth is so subjective. Sometimes you have to be negative. Sometimes you have to be positive. It's very confusing.
Right. It is there an indicator? And I always say, and this is the line I always say, that there's a very fine line between a Sudeikis, a superwoman, and a doormat. And you have to be so careful not to become a doormat because it is so attractive, because it feels like martyrdom. It feels like here I am turning myself into the sacrificial lamb and I'm giving myself over to my family. It's a very fine line. And I feel like this generation has this need to know what is the one truth. The only one truth that exists is God. Everything else is up for debate. And the Torah is very cryptic. You know, I always like wonder to myself, why couldn't God just say, do this, do this, do this, do this, and that would be the Torah. It would just solve all our problems. We wouldn't have all this gray area. We wouldn't be confused. Clearly, God is looking for the gray area. Why? If there's a gray area, individualism can rise. Our own identity can discover who I am through not knowing, right? Because if God just spat out to us what we're supposed to do, then we would all be machines doing the same thing. Obviously, he doesn't want us to all do the same things, okay?
Maybe the gray area is bitachon, like that trust in not knowing, but trusting and doing.
There's trust that's built in the gray area. It's brilliant. There's so many amazing things that come from not knowing. There's personal development. There's trial and error.
There's
mistakes.
Motivation and
there's motivation.
Drive.
We learn the most from our mistakes.
Right.
Not
if it,
knowing.
If it was black and white, you wouldn't try harder. You
right.
just
black
know.
And white. The world would look like black and white and dull and boring. Every tree is a different size, a different color, a different shape. It's very hard to do when there's only one seed that looks exactly the same as the seed before, you know? And I feel like even with diets, oh, what's the best diet? There is no best diet. Let's say, for example, I love intermittent fasting and another one of my clients is horrible with it. And some people are good with the blood type diet and some people, but everyone keeps trying to convince you that their diet is the best diet. No, you're going to try one. You're going to see this doesn't work for me. You're going to go to the next thing until you find the thing that works for you. And it's not going to be the same thing that works for the other person. But there's this desperate need for everyone to always do the same thing as each other because it confirms for me that I'm not wrong. Just confirm to yourself that you're not wrong without having to need everyone around you to do what you're doing. And I think that that's very hard for people, especially with
our
kids.
It's so ironic because everyone wants to be individual, yet everyone
right.
wants to be doing the same thing.
Right. Everyone right, wants to know they're right.
right. Right.
And so if everyone around me is doing what I'm doing, then maybe I'm right.
Right.
Just decide you're right. Don't make other people have your right. You have your right. Let them have theirs.
The best analogy I've heard on this was shared by Viktor Frankl in response to someone asking the question, what's the meaning of life? And he said, asking that question is like asking a chess grandmaster, what's the best move in the world? There's just no such thing as the best move. That's separate from the particular situation, the personality of their opponent, the context in which the game takes place. And with every move comes a whole new reality. And it's an impossible question to answer.
Yes. One example I think a lot of people can relate with is when a parent wants to go on vacation, let's say, and, you know, leave their child with, let's say, go on a little getaway with their spouse, and they feel guilty leaving their kids at home, or for work, feel guilty leaving their kids at home, then the question really is like, oh, you know, what's the truth?
It's very individual.
Yeah.
Sometimes I can tell that I'm going away to recharge myself, and sometimes I can tell I'm going away to run away from my kids.
Right.
We know. We don't want to know, but we know. We could tell the difference. And one of the ways that we know how to tell the difference is that when we go to recharge ourselves, we don't feel guilty.
Interesting.
When we go because
sometimes
we're running
people
away,
do really need to feel a recharge.
Are
but
they running
they do
toward
feel
or away from something, I guess.
Right.
Are you running towards something or you're running away from something? Maybe that's where we know.
I mean, mothers in general feel guilty about everything.
Yeah.
Okay? That's what we said in the beginning.
But you always have to say, and this is a very helpful tip I give women. If you're not sure, imagine it's your daughter. What would you tell her
right.
to do? Right? Because our kids were very healthy and balanced
right.
for our
yeah.
kids, their
right.
boundaries,
right.
not for our own. We love to martyr ourselves. We don't like to martyr our children.
There was something recently I couldn't decide what to do. And I asked Ida, what do you think I should do? She said, well, what would you tell your daughter to do?
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
And then I knew the answer right then.
I just made one of my, I'm not going to go into it, but one of my biggest, hardest life decisions I just made recently. And I did it 100% based on would I allow my daughter to experience this or not? And based on that, I made this huge life decision. And so that's something we can channel.
Yeah, we can't heal ourselves really unless we think vicariously. What would we?
We can think much more healthily towards our children than we can about ourselves because
right.
we're used to sacrificing ourselves.
Yeah.
Can you energetically heal yourself or can someone heal themselves or does it always require someone
else
to pick up
you
on
really
that?
You really can't take yourself out of prison. I have a slew of healers that I go to.
Mm-hmm.
They're my, you know, I was giving a course to other healers on crystal healing and I met a lot of other healers and there was two healers that I became obsessed with. And I go to them.
In Israel?
In Israel. And I have my therapist, which I'm crazy over. She keeps it real for me. Because sometimes when I get together with my therapist, we go past lives, this, that, and we kind of get lost in it. And she's just like, Sari, what are you doing? Like, just do this and this. And then she keeps me grounded and practical and she gives me real work. So I feel like...
She sounds good.
She's great. She's the best. She's the best. I owe her everything. But... I feel like a person should always have a slew of a team of people that support them and help them. And for some people, it's their mother. For some people, it's their sisters. For some people, it's their therapist. I mean, my sisters definitely give me support. My family gives me support, my mother. But every individual has to find their team that they trust.
Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily have to be one person. It can be.
No, it should be more. The more the merrier.
Right. So in general, you think the more the merrier.
Yes. You should have the
sometimes
person.
You can have an
the
overdose
gym. The
of
gym
different
can
opinions.
Be your therapist.
Yeah, the gym. Okay. But I'm saying you could, if you ask too many people the same thing, you could get a few different opinions and then be really confused.
Well, so I don't usually ask my therapist the questions I do with my healers.
Right. So you'll ask, you know who to go to.
I know
to
who
ask
to go to
question.
For what, you know?
So you have to know who's
yes,
good at what.
Definitely.
Yeah. I actually want to pause for a second and mention that, well, for our listeners that are listening, you're not going to actually see these, but for those watching YouTube or our reels, I'm wearing a bracelet. And these bracelets are Sarit's recommendation. I actually, I found you through Rachel Schnee, and we plan to interview her and Joyce because they're two powerhouses. Joyce,
oh, yes,
as
definitely.
We are. They're good friends, but we're very grateful that we found you through Rachel. And she sells amazing jewelry. And I asked her to send you, I heard that you can look at a picture and see what healing a person needs. So I said, can you send my picture to Sarit? So straight away she said, I'm just going to share what one of these bracelets are, is that you recommended I get the bracelet for healing in
protection.
Protection in negative energy. And I was amazed because I'm very sensitive to negative energy. I know that about myself. And I was like, wow, how did she pick that up in the picture? So these are the bracelets and I've got these stones to protect me from any negative energy. So can you share a little bit about that? Like, how long is it going to take where I don't pick up negative energy anymore?
So I'll tell you how it works. It doesn't work in the way that people think it works. It's not like a magic charm where you wear this stone and now the power of the stone gets me the negative energy to fly away like in the movies. No, I don't work like that at all. I don't believe in charms. It can be also idolatry, right? If you put your faith in a stone, it's classic idolatry. I work in a completely different way, whereas I believe that minerals come from stones. And in Judaism, you know, the high priest wore the 12 different stoves of the 12 different tribes. It has a place in Judaism. And each stone that belonged to that tribe was about a different emotional component. For example, the tribe of Benjamin was given the stone called the Yashpeh, which is red jasper. And the yashpeh in Hebrew means yashpeh, yeah, I have a mouth. And so Benjamin was very strong in the ability to control their mouth. And so that was a stone that was given to them. But red jasper is a red blood stone. It actually, if someone comes to my session and they choose red jasper first, I know they have anger and they cannot control their expressions. And so all of these elements have mineral components in them, which affect the blood. Red jasper is one of the blood stones. And so when I make combinations of stones and bracelets, I'm not actually putting it on the person, because now that they put this stone on, now negative energy can't come in them from a spiritual perspective. No, it works much more medicinally than that, meaning that every stone has a mineral component that affects a different organ in the body. Let's take, for example...
Well, can we use the example of like this negative... Oh, you're going to give
a practical
example.
I'm going to give you a practical example of like, let's say we have a bracelet called money magnet. You wear this bracelet and you open up your money muscle. Okay? Which sounds crazy. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm wearing this bracelet and now
my... Did you know such a bracelet exists?
Yes, it does.
We have a bestseller.
Right. It's one of our bestsellers.
Okay.
I'm sure it is. Yes.
We give it a catchy name because when you want to sell a product, you have to make it short and cute.
Right.
But the truth is, I'll explain to you how it works. Part of the bracelets that are in Money Magnet, for example, one of them is citron. Mm-hmm. Citron is a bladder stone. It's a stone that removes toxins from the bladder.
Okay.
Now, the bladder is the area in the body medicinally that releases all of the dirt that we have, right? We drink water, right? We drink Coke, comes out clear or comes out yellow, right? Where's all that black stuff coming? It's sitting in the bladder. And so the bladder generally is the place that cleans our shame out. Let's say you're nervous, right? People who are nervous have to frequently urinate. They keep running to the bathroom. Why is that? Because the body feels stress. It feels shame. So it takes you to clean it out of your system and it keeps you running to the toilet. So what does that mean? The bladder is the area that holds our negative energy. And so when I want to clear someone's path to finding wealth, it won't happen if the person is carrying shame, right? And a lot of the times people who are rich will have rich children. Why? Because they assume that money comes to me because that's how it was when I was a kid. They don't have a lot of shame associated with money. But if I see someone who went through shame in their childhood with money, because they didn't have money, they were poor, their parents lost money, I know that they're probably going to mimic that and pick that up. So what do I know? I need to clean their bladder out where the memories of shame is carried. So I'll use a stone like citron as one of the bracelets to clear their system out and the memory of that organ was holding on to the shame. And there's other combinations of different areas of the body that clear out shame. And that's really how it works. And the same thing with a protection bracelet. A person is vulnerable to negative energy when they don't have a feeling and a sense that I have permission to protect myself. So actually, the protection bracelet is a confident bracelet. We just don't call it that, right? Because it's much more gimmicky and alluring to say protection than for me to say, build your self-confidence and then therefore negative energy won't come on you, right? But really, it's all of the stones that give a person a sense of empowerment. And I don't deserve to be affected by people around me. I'm on my own island. And God created the entire universe for me to exist in it. And it isn't fair that I take your crap into my life. And the bracelet is affecting different organs in the body that release different emotions that give me confidence. That's really how it works.
And you decided to do, because you have your stones that you'll do personally in a session, and you decided to make these bracelets so many more people can experience.
Right. Listen, not everyone can come to me, you know, and my time is limited. Mm-hmm. And as you guys know, it's like there's a very big wait list right now to get in. And so I always knew that like I wanted to heal on a global level. And because I'm intuitive and also intuitive with stones, I know which stones, you know, when I studied the course, so there was what I was taught and then there was what I picked up. And so I ended up making combinations for different emotional things and medical things. And I wanted to be able to tell someone, listen, you're going through sickness, get body healing. Double up on it, okay? I'm not going to be able to help every single person. It's just right. Not possible.
Well, I thought it was cool because when you saw my picture, you said that I need this shield. And I felt that I did too because I'm very sensitive. I
guess you're empathic.
Empathic. And then when I came to you in person, the first thing I asked was, is the picture correct? Right. When you see me in person, is it the same? But I guess, have you ever been wrong that the picture is not the same as in person?
So Sometimes I'll misread things. I'm not a perfect person. I make mistakes, you know.
I think that's so healthy to say that.
I've surely made many mistakes in my life. Probably my biggest lessons in life were the mistakes that I made. Intuition is just what it is, intuition, and you can be wrong. And sometimes you can overly read into something. And it's a kind of like, you know, scary scenario sometimes where you sometimes read too into something and then you created a monster that doesn't even exist. You have to be very careful with it. Of course, I've made mistakes. It's not too common. Otherwise, people wouldn't come to me, right? If I'm the one that always makes mistakes. But it's enough that keeps me normal, you know. And I pray for it. I pray that I always say, God, let me make my mistakes on myself and not on my clients, because they're paying me money and they're coming here with a lot of hope and a lot of dreams, and I don't want them to be the percentage that falls through the cracks. And it does. So there are people that come to me, and the majority, 80%, I would say, love it and have a great experience and get healing. And then there's a 20% that I can't help them. They're stuck. They might not even like me. They don't connect to me. And I don't believe that there is one healing for every single person. You know, like my friends that are healers, like, sometimes they're working with someone. They're like, can you please deal with her? Like, I feel like I've given her everything I can, and she needs a fresh new perspective, and I can't give her. And I'll give her clients that I feel stuck with, that I feel like I can only take them to a certain degree. And sometimes I'll tell clients, you don't need healing. You need to go to a therapist. Like, you need to talk this out. And I'm not that person. Like, I have a limited amount of patience, and somebody can, my energy is more like, do this, let's fix this, go move on. And sometimes a person just needs to be heard, and they need a lot of empathy. And I'm definitely not the address for that, mm-hmm. because I lack patience. And I'm looking at the goal, like, get them to move on, get them married, get them. And so oftentimes I will tell somebody, go to a therapist in addition to me, and make sure the therapist is meeting all of your emotional needs, because I definitely don't have the time or emotional space to do it.
What are some of the most common blockages that you see in your clients? Let's say, for example, the chakras. I don't know how much you work with that. I feel like it's definitely a certain kind of approach, but let's say there's like the unblocking of the different parts, you know, the different energetic spaces.
I think in the secular world, they call it chakras. Judaism, we relate more to spheras, okay. which is the divisions of the body. And that's more what I relate to.
Right.
This is your crown is up here. That's your deeper understanding, right? Your chachma. Mm-hmm. There's your third eye. That's your intuition. There's a communication, which is right here. Your heart, happiness, it's a solar plexus, your decision making, and your foundation, that's your grounding.
Right.
And so Judaism relates to it more in its spheras. I relate to it more by where the different stones belong to different parts of the body. So there's stones that you choose that belong to different parts of the body. So for example, if you choose stones only from the heart area, so I know that you're an extremely sensitive and feeling person, to the degree that every other part of your body doesn't exist. All you do is go according to your emotions. So if I see someone only choosing from the heart, I know if this person needs grounding, they need to make better decisions, they need to work on their happiness, the way they think, like they're letting their emotions control their life.
Right.
So I basically relate to the different components of the body in terms of healing, and also in terms of helping the person create balance. You want to basically access every part of your body.
So what are the stones people like tend to, is there one that people
most
tend
people
to
gravitate towards? The heart chakra stones. Those are the most stones in the heart ones. Mm-hmm. The darker stones are their foundation stones, and a lot of people avoid them because most people's struggles are in their childhood. So they don't take the foundation stones because most of their hardships came from their childhood. And so one of the things I'm looking for when I work with people is getting into a place where they do choose the darker stones.
Interesting.
How would you help someone let go of trauma in their childhood?
Right. So there's so many different methods of doing it. And when I work with people, I check to see which method is the best for them. Because mm-hmm. like I said, there's so many different ways to heal. I don't believe in one way. And so I do Dr. Sarno's method of healing. I do 3D healing. I do emotion codes. I do classic healing, energy healing. I do past life regression. I do journey work. I do so many different modalities, and I check to see with that person, one brain I do, to see what's best for their body, what their body's ready for, what they can do.
Are you able to share an inspiring story of healing that you've
done? So I'll tell you the main way that I heal paradoxically as a methodology, I would say is under the umbrella of Dr. Sarno's method, which is everything that we are sick from comes from an emotional blockage, mostly.
Physically sick from.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say 80%. Sometimes there's things that are decreed from heaven that we have no control over. Sometimes it's past lives. Sometimes it's other things. But I would say the majority of the time it's emotional and that we're blocking ourselves. There's a 20% that it's not in our hands and that we're not blocking ourselves. That's harder. And there are people that come to me and I turn them away and I say, I see that I cannot help you because
it's something that's destined.
It's something that's not in my realm, mm-hmm. that I feel that I have power, any power to help you with. And so sometimes it's disappointing. I had a kid that was autistic and I helped them kind of improve their, you know, situation to some degree. And then they told all their friends in their, you know, their kid's autistic group.
Right.
And then another mother came and I said, there's no permission to work on your child. The child has to stay this way. Now, does that mean that the mother shouldn't go looking for other healers and that she's now stuck?
How did you see there was no permission?
I tap into the subconscious and the subconscious says, stay back. Leave me alone. It's not my business. So I leave it alone. And I said to the mother, I said, you know, that doesn't mean that you should give up on your kid. Go find a better healer. Maybe I'm not the one, right? I'm blocked to it.
Is it an art to tap into the subconscious? Or
you know what? I had to learn it. It wasn't like I was born. When I was a kid, I was intuitive, but it came to me.
Right.
And as an adult, I had to learn to access it.
Right. So you took learned from different healers about how to access the subconscious?
I mainly learned from, I mean, today there you can kind of, you know, you can go to YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I learned from a healer, but you can go to YouTube and learn about muscle testing. Right. And that's one of the ways people do it.
Yeah, we just interviewed Moshe Weinbaum, and my daughter does this too. You mean the emotion code?
Yeah. So emotion codes is one of the things that uses muscle testing, but a lot of modalities use muscle testing. And so muscle testing is basically the external, like people check on their muscle on their hand, or they check on the muscles like here. But really intuition is the step before that, where it's like, and oftentimes people who start off muscle testing, at some point already get the answer before they touch their muscles and they just stop muscle testing.
Yeah, because you hold my hand and close your eyes.
Right. That's just for like the ambiance.
Oh, life. Because that was good.
I don't really have to do that. I can just sit here and ask your body and your body will tell me. But that kind of creates a feeling of like you're let go.
Right.
You give me your hand. You're kind of giving me permission.
Okay.
We get into the vibe. I close my eyes. I don't have to do any of that.
Okay. Oh, good to know.
Yes. We were complimenting you on your skin earlier. And I'm just wondering, is there a...
First of all, it's a Sephardi thing. I think Sephardi have
good skin.
Good skin.
It's true.
Well, if someone comes to you with, let's say, skin concerns or issues, what's the energetic way, or what's your way of, because you said the physical stuff is usually something
right.
a little
so,
deeper.
You know, skin, according to, you know, the kind of methodology that I do, is really, it's the largest organ in the body. That's why we also, when you use our healing bracelets, we do it through absorption of the skin. The minerals absorb through the skin. But when I see people with skin disease, it's actually the thing that we see. So what that tells me is that there's something about that person that wants to put whatever they're going through internally on the outside of their body. And so therefore I know that whatever it is that they're experiencing is something that has to do with public opinion and how I'm perceived. So I look at all skin disease as perception.
Wow.
Yes. Because most of the time, the illnesses are hidden inside the body, then I know it's their own internal issues. Mm-hmm. When it's on the skin, I know it has to do with how does the society see me? And I work with people with that.
Wow.
One of the hardest things about being in this industry is that because when I work through the method of Dr. Sarno's, everything that I go through is emotional, mm-hmm. people find it very painful. Because let's say they come to me with infertility, they'll say, oh, it's my fault that I'm not having kids. You know, it's very painful to hear that you're crying every single day, 7 years, you don't have any children. And now you go to this woman, it's like, well, it's because you did this and this and this and this. And it's very hard for me. It's like the worst part of my job because on the one hand, I'm telling them, let's figure out where my part in it is. And on the other hand, I'm telling them at the end of the day, it's up to God and he's putting you through this test. How does that work together? Mm-hmm. How do you get to a place where you can work on yourself and not to feel blame like you asked in the beginning? Mm-hmm. It's a really fine line and it's very hard. It's the worst part of my job because I look at it in the sense that I don't really ultimately know why God is putting me through this test. And we can try to surmise as human beings and look at our life and our patterns and try to pick up solutions. But at the end of the day, the greater picture we'll never really know until we go into the next world after 120 years. But as human beings, we have an obligation to look inward and make ourselves better. So when a woman comes to me with infertility, the only tool I have is her. The only tool I have is her history. The only tool I have is her behavior. I'm going to use it. And yes, sometimes it makes her feel like, ugh, you're saying this is my doing. It's not my doing. I didn't want this. But I don't have any other way to access her. And I have no choice but to go into that direction and ask her what it is that she's doing in her behavior pattern. Because I don't believe that God puts us on this earth just to challenge us because of all of our past life stuff. Sometimes a little bit of that. But I think most of the time it's because he wants something from us now. And if I can figure out what that is and I can get myself to a place of balance, then God can give me what it is that I need by allowing me to open myself up to that healing.
So our healing journeys essentially never really end. Because if we get to one point, then there's something else we always want to work on.
We want that.
Right.
Because when our healing ends, we're gone.
Right.
We want to have...
always have something to heal.
Yes. And I always tell people, be involved in community acts of service. Help the greater good of the community, because then God needs you. And then you have a purpose. And then even if you're done with your own work, which I don't think we ever are, you have a purpose in the universe and God can work through you. You know, I always say that the dead are jealous of us because whatever they did, they did. And we live in a world where we can affect change and we can create good. And it's so godly and it's so beautiful and it's so exciting because we can affect other people's life. And one, you know, like you throw a stone and it creates waves. So we have an opportunity to live in this world and create waves.
Well, that's part of the healing. It's not just healing ourselves, but healing the world.
Absolutely. Sometimes I'll tell people, stop healing the world, heal yourself. You can affect that in a much more cosmic way.
You mean heal yourself and then you can heal the world?
I mean, I don't say to pause. First heal yourself and then say that, because then I would probably never have helped anyone because I'm still a major work in progress. But I say do both at the same time. And there are people that I say, do not heal other people at all. Only focus on yourself.
And why would you tell someone that?
Because those are people who run away to helping other people because they can't deal with their own stuff. So then I say, you're not balanced. Stop running away to helping other people because you don't want to face yourself.
You mean they're only helping other people and they're just not helping themselves?
Yes.
So you need to do a balance of both. But
yes.
If they are healing themselves, then they should be able to heal someone else.
Not always. Not always. That's not in everyone's cards.
Okay. Right.
But maybe because Ida was bringing up earlier that people can get into a cycle of healing, 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 and then they forget that they're needed in the world.
Right.
One question I often have or pose is how do we know if we're on the right track? So people who are on a growth journey or dedicated to self-growth will often experience a certain degree of tension, which is like a normal part of this process. I mean, without the tension, we wouldn't have this deep desire to grow. At the same time, having, you know, with this in mind, like is there a way of measuring or knowing whether we're going in the right direction? So many people are on a growth journey, but maybe they end up making decisions that hurt the people around them, or they're on a growth journey and they find themselves experiencing maybe more tension than they're comfortable with. I think for me, it's just a question of like, how can I be fully present all the time while I change and develop as a person and become better and work on myself? Like, how do I get there? And is there a way of knowing if I'm heading in the right direction?
We can't be consistently present all the time, and we shouldn't set ourselves up for failure. I always say that in my opinion, and it could be wrong, and it could be other people will listen to this and say that's the dumbest thing, but I'll tell you what my truth is I always look for balance, a middle road, for equilibrium. And it changes all the time, because sometimes in order to balance myself out, I have to go to the opposite extreme because I was in one side. So balance looks different for every single person because we don't know where you're holding. And making sure you have checks and balances and place, basically one of the indications is anxiety. And that's why everyone in this generation suffers from anxiety, because most people are out of balance. Our body signals to us that we're out of balance when we start to get anxious, right? That's not something we should dope up with medication in order to remove that feeling. Anxiety is a conversation our body's having with us. Why is it making me anxious? What's going on? What is out of balance in my life? What is out of line? So I think one of the ways we know that we're in the right spot is that we feel good and we're happy. Right. If we're anxious and we're not in a good space and running around like a chicken without a head, something's wrong.
Right. So if I've been on this growth journey for 5 years, but I'm still feeling anxiety,
what's going on?
I need to recalibrate is what you're saying. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we can't just blindly trust this growth process without
You have to check in with yourself all the time.
Right.
And see, how am I feeling about myself?
Right.
Am I happy? You know, like, we don't want to be so driven that we have a goal, but we lost quality of life.
Right.
And that we've rammed through every single person in our life to get to our goal, whatever that is.
Right. Relationships also. How are our closest relationships faring? Like, how are those doing?
It's basically that. They did a study. I think this is the longest term study for people who graduated from Harvard. And they asked them over 70 years at the end of the day, who has the best quality of life? And they all said that the people who felt they had really healthy interpersonal relationships with their family were the ones that were the happiest, not the ones that made the most money. And so,
makes sense.
You have to keep checking with yourself. Like, do the people around me like me?
Right.
Are my kids happy with me? Is my spouse? Right. Is my friends? Like, am I liked in society? You know, like, you're not always going to have. And my rabbi once told me, like, sweet, if you're not making enemies, you're probably not doing anything. I can definitely say that about myself. And there are people that are always going to go.
A few, relatively speaking.
Yeah. But there's always going to be people that go up against the grain. Even when I started my bracelet business, everyone's like, ah, it's idolatry. It's isn't like, without even asking me what it means, what it's coming from.
Right.
There was people who made fun of it. When I first became a healer, I was made so much fun of from my friends, from community, from society and healer. What is this? And I was kind of a laughingstock in the beginning, but I remembered what my Rav said. He said, if there's opposition, you're probably onto something. So go for it.
It's true. Can I ask you, though, about the bracelets? How long, when you wear the stones, like, what happens? I'm saying it brings...
So for every single person is different. Like, some of the bracelets that we work with, like the anxiety bracelets, they work pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Like some people say within a half an hour. And there are the bracelets that are more long-term bracelets. Like the money magnet bracelet takes longer. It takes a few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
The detox bracelets take a little bit longer because you're basically cleaning yourself from a lot of negativity that you're carrying over the years.
Right.
The trauma bracelets, before we've seen feedback from people, are immediate. Anxiety is immediate because it's basically bringing everything to the surface.
What about negative energy?
So the protection is it varies. It's the bracelet that varies with different people.
Mm-hmm.
But most people right away start to feel a lot more confident in saying no.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, suddenly they're speaking up much more for themselves, which is what I told you is really what the bracelet is really about. And so people just will be a lot more confrontational than they're used to, and a lot more, you know.
Okay, so if you start saying no to me a lot,
you'll know it's working.
Right.
I can't say no to her.
I mean, I always, like, for me, I wear the emotional eating braces. I'm such an emotional eater. And so when I take it off, I immediately feel like that feeling goes away. There are braces that I feel that are long-term healing.
Mm-hmm.
You wear it and it actually fixes it.
Okay.
And so far, I've only been wearing it for, I don't know, a few weeks now. I feel like immediately when I take off my emotional eating braces, I go back. So there are the braces that are kind of working when they're on you and don't work when they're off you. So I'm not going to lie.
Mm-hmm.
And we're kind of learning about the bracelets because we're in the beginning stages of this company.
Uh-huh.
And we're getting a ton of feedback from people. This works fast. This works slow. And we're picking up a pattern with different braces of what different braces affect.
Right.
So for me personally, there are braces that work long-term and they actually fix it, like the trauma bracelet. Like, you wear it. And then you feel like this trauma is being picked up, and then it gets released, and then you feel better, and you don't need to wear the bracelet anymore. And then there's, so far with the emotional eating, I feel like I always need to wear it. So it's trial and error. And some people, it's the best on the left hand, some people on the right hand. You have to kind of change it and see what feels, you feel more effective. Some people, it takes weeks. Some people, it's immediate. Everyone is different.
What about sleep? Is there one for sleep?
Yes.
And people sleep well?
Yes.
That's great.
Listen, some people... I would say that 80% think is phenomenal. And then there's a 20% that say it doesn't work. And probably they're not sleeping for a different reason than why I made the bracelet.
Right.
So I made the bracelet for racing thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
Or people who are overstimulated.
Right.
So some people don't sleep because they might have some sort of disease or some sort of illness or some other mental issue that has nothing to do with what I made the bracelet for.
Right.
And it might not work for them, and it's hit or miss.
Yeah.
It's kind of like antibiotics, you know? It doesn't work for everyone, penicillin. Some people it does.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We never actually brought this topic up, and you touched upon it before, and that is the narcissist.
Ooh,
yeah.
The narcissist.
I just, because you touched upon it, I wanted to bring it up and ask you, is it easy for you when someone comes in to pick up that they're a narcissist, and can you actually help the narcissist? And also someone, let's say, who is living with the narcissist, are you able to help them to live with the narcissist?
So I'll tell you, narcissists don't usually come to me because narcissists, I'm their biggest nightmare because I'm basically all about like, let's see what I'm doing wrong. Narcissists don't want to know that. I would say that in the last 2 years, I've had two narcissists.
That
and they're women. Okay. And they're not high level narcissists. They're narcissistic. But like you said, it's not like pathological. And a lot of people wonder, like, is it curable narcissism? And I say that, you know, we all have a little bit of narcissism in us. It's natural. It's normal. If we didn't, we wouldn't want to put ourselves out there. We wouldn't want to wear makeup. We wouldn't want... We kind of need every single attribute in the universe because it helps us to get to where we want to. Even anxiety is important because anxiety will make me drive slower so I don't get into a car accident. It makes me eat healthy so I don't get sick, right? If I didn't care or think about anything, if I didn't get anxious ever, I would probably be like a manic person. So narcissism has a place too because it makes us take care of ourselves a little bit. It's when it becomes overrun that it's problematic. And so there's levels of narcissism. A high level narcissist isn't going to be at my table. Well, what happens when you're married to a narcissist? And I would have to say that most empaths are married to narcissists. So people who are very empathetic, passive, too excessively giving, usually end up with narcissists, I would say 50% of the time. Sometimes empaths marry shields, men that are very protective and strong and are always trying to help them and protect them, right? That's the happy scenario. But 50% of the time empaths marry. Why? Because we're kind of on the same frequency, but opposite ends of it. So someone who only feels good when they're giving is going to attract someone who only wants to take.
Right.
That's just how it works. So when I'm working with someone who is married to a narcissist, I don't tell her, leave him, stay with him. It's kind of her decision. It doesn't matter to me also.
What are telltale signs of narcissism?
But I'll tell her, let me just finish this thought, to stop giving so much. And then naturally the narcissist leaves because it's finished feeding off of that person.
You mean he leaves the relationship?
He leaves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that person doesn't have to make any changes. Because what I teach an empath is stop giving everything away. Say no. Have boundaries. Be balanced. And as soon as they start to do that, the narcissist looks for another victim.
So like, how would you describe a narcissist? How would you describe an empath? Like,
right. So an empath has this problem where they're missing the shield around them that kind of stops them or creates a boundary between their feelings and other people's feelings.
Okay.
And so what happens is they'll be around other people and they'll feel, oh my God, this person is so sad. They need this. They're so lonely. So they feel like, because I felt it, that means I'm obligated to now fix it, which isn't true. You felt it because you have some sort of interesting gift, but that doesn't mean you need to act on it. But what happens is an empath feels this pain of the other person and now it's sitting on them. And they think the only way to get rid of that pain is by taking away that person's problem. Now you've just become a slave to their emotions.
Right.
Very dangerous. And it also builds codependency. Now the other person never fixes themselves and learns the healthy tools of making their life better because you're fixing it for them. Now there's a codependent relationship where you get hurt and they get hurt. And so what I teach an empath is just because you feel other people's emotions is not a cue for you to fix it for them. It's not. Okay. And so once they start to learn balance in themselves, right? And they learn to put other people's emotions aside, then they're able to come more into a balance and not attract that kind of personality anymore. But then you can ask, then why would Hashem make someone empathic, right? If he doesn't want us to help other people. empathy is there in order to feel the other person and to affect change by example, not by doing it for them. That's the difference. Okay? It's like creating, an empath will not save another person, but they'll create a system that that person can go to and save themselves. Kind of like what you do and what you do.
It's like there's an analogy of if someone's cold, instead of giving them your coat, build a fire.
Beautiful. Teach them how to make a fire.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
And so it sounds like someone who's an empath will likely attract a narcissist because it's that kind of complementary.
Because they only feel good.
Right.
When they're relieving that feeling of doing and saving the other person. Otherwise, they don't feel they have any value. They feel bad when they do for themselves. They feel like they're self. The empath and the narcissist are the same person, actually. Both of them don't have an identity. Okay? I have no identity unless I give. I have no identity unless I receive. That's why they always align with each other. Hmm.
So the way to work through that,
to create an identity for yourself outside of giving.
Right. So it's really up to the empath, it sounds like.
Right.
To build boundaries.
The narcissist is very hard to cure.
Right.
Because there isn't that self-awareness.
Right. Interesting.
An empath usually ends up fixing themselves through a lot of painful experiences.
Right.
And have you ever seen a narcissist heal?
Yes, I have. Definitely. And I believe that everybody can have a possibility to heal. Is it common? No. It's not common because they don't come...
Because they don't self-identify as a narcissist.
Right. Well, the ones that do...
If someone say, I'm a narcissist, I need help. Right.
The ones that do get help.
Right. Right. Or the ones where the empath builds boundaries and let's say, you know,
maybe that will enable that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But it's nice to hear that a narcissist can, that it is possible.
It's possible. I think anything is possible. It's not common.
Right.
Right. If you could choose five key tips or like five... fundamental things, or maybe the three or five that you feel are most effective, or that if you could share five things with the entire world, because now your time is so limited, what are the like five things that you would say if we start doing these things that we are well on the path toward healing?
Wow, that's a very broad question, but you know what? It's something that I should have at the tip of my tongue. But I would say that the tips that I use the most for myself is, number one, something that I learned over many years of struggling is self-care. I'll have nothing to give if I'm not receiving myself. So before you start on the path of making your life better, first you have to fill up with fuel. And so one of the things I think originally I heard this in this book called The Empowered Wife, where she says, take 30 things that you love doing, not the result of, but the actually love the process of doing, and make sure you do several of those things a day. So the first thing I would tell people is make sure you have enough in your life that is self-care, that actually fills your void, that makes it possible for you to live in society. Okay? So oftentimes people come in for healing. I won't do anything until I don't see that they're a normal human being and they're eating well and that they're sleeping a normal amount of time and that they're doing things that they love and that they have. First, you have to like be human before you can affect change. You know, let's go to the basics and look at your life and say, what's not normal about how I live? Like, what's unbalanced? Am I getting like 6 to 7 hours of sleep at night at least? You know what I'm saying? Like, am I in negative relationships? Am I living with an abusive person? Like, first I look at the SOS. Like, what is in this person's life technically that's seriously problematic? And how do we stop that? That's number one. And I would say that the next stage of a person's healing is, where do I want to go? So often, people just don't have any direction. And I'll ask somebody, what do you want? And they look at me, they're like, I don't know. I don't even know who I am. I don't even know what I want. So I would say that those two first questions is my life balance? Am I eating, sleeping, doing for myself? Am I being attacked on a daily basis? Like, first, let's make my life normal. Second stage is, what do I want? Okay. You know, people can come to me with infertility and I'll say, well, what do you want? right? And I'll say, I really want kids. And then I'll look a little deeper and I'm like, no, you don't. You're terrified of kids. You hate kids, you know? And like, they're so sure that this thing that they're looking for is what they're looking for. And they become obsessed with it. But in reality, we just scratch the surface a little bit and they realize like, they don't really actually want kids.
So what are they looking for?
Looking to be normal like everyone else who has kids. They're looking for validation from the child. They're looking for something to do and to be busy with because they're actually afraid of finding their own career, okay? And sometimes God will withhold something from us because we're using that thing as a way to hide, you know? I mean, the majority of women who say they want kids. It's human nature to want to be fruitful and multiply.
Right.
But I'm saying, oftentimes people will come to me and they don't even know what it is that they want. You know,
out of life or in general?
In general. They don't have a goal.
Problem.
Yeah, they don't know what their life's purpose is.
Right.
And I always say, kids are amazing, but be careful that you don't make it your life's purpose because kids grow up and they get married and they have their own life.
And then
you'll know what happens and you're left without a life's purpose. I always say, for me, my greatest life's purpose and my only goal is that after 120, I meet my maker and he says to me, I'm so proud of you. That's all I want. And when a person sets that goal, it's not limited to any specific one thing because you can do a million things to make God happy. And that's my personal goal.
Right. That you were living your own life and not someone else's
right.
version
and that,
of it.
And that can sometimes change because right now my career gives me so much pleasure. But if God forbid God took that away from me, then would I disappear off the face of this earth? Would I have no purpose?
You'd find...
We have to be able
look
to
look out
be,
for another purpose.
Yes, we have to be able to be expandable.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So that was three things. We've got two more.
We can weave it into the quotes.
Yeah, yeah.
We end with quotes.
I actually want, before we wrap up, you had shared with me when I met you that you had met the Lubavitcher Rebbe and we're Chabad women. Do you also, maybe you also consider yourself Chabad in some way, but I know you met the Rebbe and you had said that you felt the Rebbe saw right through you. So I wanted you to share this
experience
with us.
You know, there's a very special woman. Her name is Sara Carmeli. And she was the bat mitzvah teacher of the Persian community where I come from. And she taught all of our generation, all of the bat mitzvah stuff. I think she's a very famous speaker in the Lubavitcher community.
Yes.
Very special woman. And when we were children, it was one of her life's missions to get as many children into the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So I remember every Sunday.
That's amazing.
She was an incredible woman. I remember going with my family and she would coerce everyone to go and to get a dollar from the Rebbe.
And you lived here in
I lived
United
in Queens.
States? Oh, you lived in Queens, yeah.
And I remember like, okay, we're going to go. We're going to go online. We're going to see the Rebbe. He's going to give you a dollar.
How old were you?
I think I was 6 or 7. She had taken us multiple times. I remember this happening multiple times. I didn't know anything about the dollar, why he was giving me a dollar. I think I bought candy with it, actually. I didn't even know I was supposed to keep it. And I think that's why I'm obsessed with sugar today, because I'm like, I ate with the Rebbe's dollar candy, and now it's embedded in me. But since then, I've gotten dollars from other people.
Okay, good.
Yes.
May it bring you many brachas.
Yes. And when I remember going up to him, and I remember that he looked me in the eyes, you know, with his gorgeous crystal blue eyes. And I actually felt like he washed through me with his eyes. It was the most surreal experience I ever had. And very often, that feeling of him looking through every part of me and sort of like seeing every part of me with his eyes, like he just went through me. Sometimes when I have moments of doubt, I try to conjure that moment again where another human being was able to see through me. And it gives me kind of a healing where I know that I exist, you know. And so often in our lives, sometimes another Jew can look at another Jew and just see them in their pain and where they're holding. And that's enough to give them life force. And I always think that that's what that Rebbe did that. He looked into the eyes of every Jew and he gave them a dollar. And he says, you have value more than monetary. I'll take my money and I'll give it to you. I'll give it to everybody. I'll give it to the whole world. I don't care about it.
He saw us for our potential and who we are.
And he looked in the eyes of every single Jew and he said, you exist. And that's really our whole life's purpose is to get to a place where I know, Bishvili Nivra Olam, from the beginning of time until the end of time, The entire universe was built so that I exist in it. And if a person really has that value, they can do anything.
Endless potential.
Right.
Thank you for sharing that.
You're very welcome.
I felt the same way walking past the rabbi, that he saw me for who I am and saw my potential and believed in me. So I very much relate to that.
Yes.
But what else is something that impacted you or changed you?
You know, since I was a kid, I struggled with, you know, I went through a lot of different painful, traumatic experiences as a child. And I remember when I was around 12 years old, I thought, do I have a target on my head? Like, is God out to get me? Is there something wrong with me? Am I hated by God that I had to go through all these different painful experiences at such a small age? And today I look back and I see that every single thing I experienced as a child was actually a tool that I used today in my healing. And that today, anybody that comes to me, no matter what they experienced, I'm not overwhelmed by it. I actually believe they can overcome it. It doesn't matter what it is. And so I think that the greatest thing that I've learned in my life was that all of my gifts came from my pain. And in life, pleasure and pain, there's such a fine line. Think about birth, right? It's like you think you're going to die, actually. And you might, actually. And there's blood everywhere. And at that moment where it's the worst, life comes out. Think about intimacy between a man and a woman. The pleasure and the pain are right there together, right? Like right before, it's like almost painful. So you have a release and there's ecstasy. Pleasure and pain come hand in hand. And so when I look at my childhood and I look at the pain, I think, what pleasure came after that? You look at a doctor, why does a doctor make a lot more money than a regular person? Because he had the pain of 7 years of studying and the pain of student loans. And so he has to be rewarded according to that. So the pain is valued against the pleasure that comes after. And so in this world, I think one of the greatest lessons that I've learned is that I don't look at pain as bad. We don't really know what bad is. We only know what God tells us bad is, because every generation it changes. We go according to what God says is good or bad, because every generation that could change. There's places in the universe, there's cannibalism. Who says it's wrong to eat people? Not that tribe in Africa. God says so. So we kind of go according to what he sets as the rules for what's right and wrong. But outside of that, there's also a lot of pain and a lot of pleasure. And so when I look back at my painful experiences, I look to see what gift came from it, because there's always a gift. And so I would say the biggest lesson in life is, and the biggest healing thing, and I would say that was number four in the five things, is that if you really want to evoke healing for yourself, go back to your childhood and look at the same story from different eyes. You know, you could have a kid in the supermarket and you can have this kid screaming and crying, I want candy, I want candy, I want candy, right? And the mom is standing there and she says, I told you that if you complain and if you cry, I'm going to leave the stuff at the supermarket, I'm going to take you back, leave you with a housekeeper, and you're never coming with me to the supermarket again. And the kid continues to bother his mother and she grabs him, she leaves the car and she drives home. You and I can both be standing next to each other and you can look at that and be like, oh my God, kind of a mother is that? She embarrassed him. She could have just explained to him. She didn't have any patience. Now she's living with a housekeeper, right? I can look at exactly the same scenario and say, lucky kid, his mother is a woman of her word. Now he's actually going to learn a lesson. And now he's going to be able to know that there's consequences to what you do. What's the truth? The truth isn't in the action, because we don't really know what happened. The truth is in our interpretation of what happened. And so we can go back into our childhood and interpret something good from it, the lesson. The trauma turns into a gift. And I would say that that's one of the most important things in life, is to look, be able to look back. And one of the things I help my clients do, and reinterpret their past into a way where it builds them instead of crushes them. Give them a new perspective.
That's beautiful. So when you see a client come in and they're in their pain right then,
right,
it's hard for them to see that it's a gift. You know what I mean?
Well, I definitely don't start off with that.
I'm saying
I've had some very hard cases.
But I do believe that the things that we go through are the things that make us grow.
I definitely don't start off with that. I start with empathy.
But I'm saying,
sympathy.
But you see when they come in and they're going through their pain, that one day you hope that you're able to help them, that they can see it as a gift.
Right. Listen, your child, God forbid, dies in a car accident. I don't know that in this lifetime they'll see it as a gift.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they'll definitely know that they learned lessons. And they'll tell you that right away too. So there's lessons and there's gifts. We have to kind of tread carefully when we work with people who are going through trauma.
Yeah.
How we word things and how we say things. You have to be sensitive to people's pain. Yeah.
I would recommend the book, The Choice by Edith Eger. She's a Holocaust survivor who became a psychotherapist, and she used her trauma in her own healing journey and then became a
a
therapist.
Read that.
Yeah, she wrote the book at 90.
Wow.
She was 92 years old when she wrote the book. 92. Talk about second chances and, and late bloomers, but it's a fabulous book.
Yeah.
Thank you. I'll read
so,
it.
No, okay. And she ends her book after all the trauma she's been through that she feels the youngest she's ever felt now.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, her message is what you just shared.
Yeah.
Well, she's rather the rest to represent that because there's nothing worse than that.
Right, exactly.
But you can only see it that way if you've done work. I'm saying you can only see the lesson or the gift of your trauma if you've done...
And also if you've left the trauma, meaning if you're in it... And
that's what I'm saying. When you're in it...
You revel in it. And I would say there's very few people I won't work with. Victim personalities come to me, and if we can get out of it, they'll continue to work with me. But if they won't leave it, they cannot work with me. There's nothing that triggers me more than a victim. You're allowed to come in as a victim. You were victimized by something. You can't revel in it, and you can't love it, right?
Saying someone doesn't, a victim personality, someone who doesn't take responsibility for their
guilt. Someone who wants, who only feels validation, staying a victim.
Okay.
Does staying a victim mean blaming somebody else or?
It's not so much about blaming someone else. It's looking at themselves forever through the eyes of, that's the essence of who I am.
Right.
And I only feel validation when I'm victimized.
Right.
So when I start to first give empathy and sympathy, which is a very short period of time that I'm going to give you that. Afterwards, I'm like, okay, let's get to work. And I feel a very strong resistance to a person affecting change because they get so much attention and respect and money sometimes and validation from staying in the victim place. I can't work with them.
Right.
It's very hard for me.
Right.
Again, I have patience a little bit.
Yeah. But then, so when you go through pain, let's say you're experiencing some pain, like you've experienced pain in the past. Let's say you're experiencing pain in the present. Will you heal through thinking about how you grew from the past? Pain.
Well, it's one of the tools I use. You have to, again, be very sensitive to people because you can't always say when you have a child who commits suicide, let's see how we, you know, how that was good for us. No, you have to be very sensitive and you have to pay attention to people's.
I was talking about your own, like you were sharing your own personal thing, how you've grown and changed from your pain. I was asking about your own pain. When you go through, if you ever go through a painful experience in the present, do you look at the past to see how you've grown?
And from a pain.
Yeah.
Absolutely, definitely. I always look back and say, Hashem has always been there for me throughout all of those difficult times. It's not any different now. And I know that I'm going to make it through. Mm-hmm. And I can rely on looking at my past and looking at God's amazing credentials for saving the day in my life. And for sometimes also feeling like he abandoned me because I've learned so much from the abandonment. You know, I heard Rabbi Kellerman talk about, you know, that there's that poem, Footprints.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone says, when I was going through my hardest times, that's when God held me. So Rabbi Kellerman actually said something very brilliant. He said that that's actually not true. That was written by a 14-year-old girl. And in Judaism, we do not believe that. We actually believe systematically that when we go through hard times, God actually moves away from us and he leaves us alone. Because then we come into our own power. God doesn't need to put us in this world, put us through challenges and hold us while we're going through the challenge. What's that about? God puts us into this world and he turns his face away so that we can become a hero and we can become like God and we can have the courage and we have the courage. Can he watch us and see us as we're going through it? Yes, but he makes us fix us. He doesn't do it for us. And there are times that we can see God more revealed and he's very close to us. It's not usually the time that we're affecting change. Usually when we're going through our hardest challenges in life, we don't feel God. And he does that on purpose so that we have no choice but to use the gifts and the skills that we have in order to become effective leaders, in order to affect change. If he's holding us, then we haven't done anything.
Like cuddling, right?
Interesting.
Right.
But sometimes you could be in a really dark, low place, and that's when you actually feel Hashem with you.
For sure. But you're pulling him to you.
Yeah,
right.
You're accessing him by giving yourself permission to say, in this space you exist, God. And only we can do that. I think that that's actually one of the highest levels a person can reach when they're in that dark space to say, God, I know you're here now too. But it's your acknowledgement of God and putting him in that space that makes him be in that space. And only you can do that.
Okay, so we've covered a lot. And, yeah.
we can always go on for hours.
Yes, and we could.
Rivka and I love to, we always like to kind of bring everything together and end with a quote because Rivka and I both love quotes. And I think that one sentence, so much can be encapsulated. So we're wondering if you have a favorite quote or...
So I'll tell you what I tell most of my clients all the time. And the quote is this, no one is ever going to love you as much as you can love yourself. You're your biggest advocate. And if you wait your whole life and expect other people to save you, fix you, help you, love you, you might wait forever. If you knew it's up to you to give yourself and you pour all of yourself into yourself and all of your time and energy into giving yourself whatever it is you need to become a better person, then you're the most powerful person because you're not codependent. You're not relying on other people. You're not needy. Most marriages, most relationships, with our kids in life, they can turn sour when we come into that relationship and we need someone to make me feel a certain way, make me feel loved. But true healthy love looks like I love and respect myself so much that that love is filled up within me and everyone that comes in contact with me, that love pours out into them. Now, if a husband is doing that and you're doing that, every time you're with each other, you're pouring love all over each other. But if I'm empty and he's empty, and every time we're together, I need him to give me this and this and this in order to make me feel good. He's going to feel that every time he's with me, I'm sucking the life force out of him. And I'll be disappointed when he's not looking at me, giving me attention. But if I'm so fulfilled and I'm so happy with who I am and I'm working on myself and I'm doing all the things I need to do to be happy, then I'm bursting with love that's pouring over everyone that's around me. And everyone loves to be with a person who's happy. But how can you be happy if you're not feeling fulfilled and filled up? So fill your cup, so that other people don't need to do it for you.
What a great message. I once heard someone say, people assume relationships are 50-50, but they're not. They're in fact 100-100, because if we bring our full self to the table, that's how we can ultimately actualize our relationship in the best way possible. It's not easy to do, but I think self-love is part of that. If I can just fill myself up completely, then I'm suited to love the people around me.
And I always say, the people that everyone wants to be around are the people that when you're with them, they evoke happiness mm-hmm. and joy, and you don't feel drained by them.
Right.
Right? They're not taking anything from you.
Right.
I think that's a good explanation for V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, loving your neighbor as yourself.
That is beautiful.
Well, you're the one that just gave the explanation.
Right. No, but you put it into terms that the whole Torah stands on that.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
So thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for this opportunity. Really,
what a
very special ladies, I have to say.
Right back at you.
Yes, Dido. Thank you for filling our cup.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been an honor, privilege.
And for teaching us to love ourselves.